Hi, and welcome to today's meeting of Book Hoarders Anonymous. Let's all begin by introducing ourselves.
Hi, I'm Shannon, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, I'm Erin, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Erin.
Hello, fellow book hoarders. This is Erin.
And Shannon.
And we are the head book hoarders of this podcast, but based on all of the tweets and emails we've been receiving, we know that there are fellow book hoarders out there, so we're not alone.
No! In fact, it was really interesting. I was visiting a friend over spring break and happened to have been introduced to a friend of hers. Hi, Stuart, if you're listening. And we were talking about podcasts, and he said, oh, I just found this great podcast. It's called Book Hoarders Anonymous.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
I realized that I was that Shannon.
Well, now he knows. That's fabulous.
I thought it was really cool.
And we've gotten some tweets from some other folks who are interested in serving in the capacity of third chair if we ever get this podcast around to having momentum enough to get a third person added. So that's really cool. Thank you all so much for your support. And we've had some other people contributing book news of various sorts to us as well.
Yes, we're very grateful for all that. And we do accept bribes. So, you know, just think about that for when the third chair comes around.
Yeah, definitely bribes, you know, of any kind. So think about it.
Yeah.
And we'll let people know when, you know, we decide that we'll let people know when and if we decide to have, you know, other guests, people come on who can make the show even more lively than it already is.
Apparently it's lively enough, so that's a good thing.
And we've gotten some emails, people saying they really enjoy it. And didn't you get an email from someone saying that we ramble dizzily?
Well, actually, the word that they, like, the word I used was supposed to be ditzily, but autocorrect.
Oh.
When I tweeted it.
Oh, I see. Okay, so I thought dizzily.
But I like the idea of rambling dizzily, like, because it probably fits. I probably do talk around and around in circles without making any points. So.
Yeah, I think both of us tend to do that, so that's why I thought it was so funny, because I thought, you know, other people notice that we talk in circles. Dizzily, that's such a wonderful word. But yeah, I can see how autocorrect makes the weirdest mistakes.
Yep, it really does. And apparently we've been told that, like, we say like, way, like, too, like, much.
Like, oh my god.
Yeah. So, like, I'm gonna, like, try, like, not to do that.
Like, at all. So, okay. Well, we'll try and, like, correct those mistakes.
As we go.
As we go along. So, go ahead.
Should we start out by discussing what we're reading?
Yeah, I was just going to say, we have homework. You know, the homework this time was The Hunger Games. Everyone knows that, who's been following us, because it's not like I haven't been saying it for every day. You know?
Every day.
I've been tweeting something about it a lot, especially since I went to see the movie. So we all know that. But other than that, because we're both book hoarders and we read a ton, so what have you been reading this past month?
I have been reading mostly school-related things because I'm hitting into the last month of the semester, so right now my actual pleasure reading has been somewhat curtailed.
Mm-hmm.
But I did read, since we last met, I read The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern, which was interesting. It was, like, I read it on Audible, and it was narrated by Jim Dale, who is here from the U.S. Mm-hmm. He is the voice of Harry Potter. And it was really, I wasn't sure what I was going to think about Jim Dale reading something that wasn't Harry Potter, but he did a really good job with it. And it's an interesting book about, kind of a magical circus. And these two people who are drawn together because they have been instructed by these mysterious musicians that they're going, or musicians, magicians.
Ah.
I can talk. These mysterious magicians that have been, like, tutoring them in the art of magic, and they're supposed to play this game in which they compete to find out which of them has the better magical prowess, and then the circus gets kind of intertwined with that, and it starts out very slowly, but then for me, like, I got to about halfway through the book, and I was like, I'm not sure I'm going to finish this, mm-hmm. and then there was this massive thing that happened in the plot that I did not see coming, and it was like, oh,
well,
okay, well, now you got me hooked.
Yeah, that's very cool. I really like books like that, where I can, you know, I don't see something really big coming, and when the really big thing, you know, hooks me into the book. So that's fascinating. And actually, there aren't that many of them. A lot of books, sadly, are very predictable.
They really are, and I really did not know where that one was going.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I read a book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter.
Oh my gosh.
Which was all about the kind of feminine, or like the Disney princess movement, and like why it is that like today's girls have kind of grown up with all these images of princesses, and it's very feminist. And I was a little disappointed because I like the last fourth of the book is like her references, but she writes in a very non-scholarly style. So it was like, why is there so much book and all it is
references?
References.
Who wrote the book? Who wrote the book?
Peggy Orenstein.
Okay.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah.
And that got me reading. Now I'm reading something called Spinning Straw into Gold, which is talking about fairy tales and what they symbolize for women.
Ooh, that's wonderful. I love it. And is that by the same person?
No, that's by, I think her name is Joan Gould.
And for some reason, that name sounds familiar. Maybe I read something of hers in college ages and ages ago, but
I don't know. She's like a little more scholarly than I might like for my like bedtime reading. But then I do tend to read nonfiction before I fall asleep, because then I don't feel so bad about backtracking.
Right.
I'm not sure I agree with her take on fairy tales, but I really kind of liked that her take on Cinderella was that Cinderella isn't so passive. Like, she doesn't wait for a prince, you know, she has to kind of find in herself, at least in the original story, how to, you know, get to be worthy of, you know, love and things like mm-hmm. that. And I kind of like that idea of Cinderella being that way. So it's kind of a different take on the same theme as the last one. But
any other books that you've read recently?
Well, I read The Hunger Games. I haven't read that much.
Obviously, you've got school going on. So
yeah, I haven't read that much fiction, unfortunately. I've started a couple of things. I have a couple of young adult things that I've been reading. One of which was a book I read when I was a kid that Bookshare got. It was it's called Rabble Starkey, and it's about this little this girl that lives in West Virginia, and her mom's kind of little bit of a. I mean, she's kind of a hillbilly type kid growing up, and her mom's a bit of a I'm not quite sure how to put this nicely, but she was not necessarily from the she did not have perhaps the best morals and
Trailer Park.
Yeah And it like it's really cool because I feel like the author is just kind of like treating that as normal, and like, you know, like, mom obviously loves her kid, and whatever mistakes she might have made, like, it hasn't traumatized her daughter any. And right. I remember reading it as a kid, and there's, like, some other stuff in there, too, about, like, mental illness and things like that. And it seems like the kind of book, and it was written by Lois Lowry, who wrote...
Lois Lowry is wonderful.
Yeah, she wrote The Giver, and she wrote all like a ton of classic children's
books. The Anastasia books. Krupnik, Anastasia. I've read most of them.
Those are all like up on Bookshare. Apparently they like added a ton of her books fairly recently.
Most of them are on Bard too.
Yeah.
The Giver is not. However, the sequels to The Giver, Messenger and something about Blue.
Gathering Blue.
Gathering Blue. They're on Bard, but The Giver is not, and I don't understand quite why.
I've not read those.
It's on Webrail.
I read The Giver several times, but I have not been able to bring myself to read the sequels. I think because I felt like that story was done.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it was one of those things where she wrote it to be done, and then it was so good that, you know, she wrote sequels to it. But it really did feel done. You're right.
Yeah.
She makes the sequels kind of tie into it loosely, but, you know, it felt done, and I felt like the sequels were just sort of add-ons. They were good, but they weren't as good as that little story was.
Yeah.
Well, I've been reading, I tried, because we discussed last time that one of your favorite Stephen King reads was It by Stephen King. I think I have made it halfway through the book, but it's been a struggle, I have to say.
How come?
I don't know. It just seems like it's taking forever for anything to happen. And perhaps I'm being influenced by Stephen King's later comments on the book when he said it was very bloated and he took too long to make things, you know, come out the way they were supposed to. And I feel like it's taking forever. It's 40 hours long.
Yeah.
That's an awful long book.
I think for me, that book is special because I read it. Well, first of all, I read it too young. I think I was probably about the age of the kids.
Whoa.
That were.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting because I reread it like years later and I'm like, why is Stephen, like, I don't remember Stephen King using like horrible like slurs for women's body parts that he uses.
Oh, yeah. Like, and you just, like, when you read it, it didn't register.
As a kid, it didn't register. Well, not that I knew what that word even was.
Well,
you know?
That's the thing. You just didn't know.
But it was kind of, it really shocked me.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it did. Yeah, because they have some kids in that book that aren't very nice.
No.
But actually, I like the book, but it just seems, it really, let's put it this way, I liked it, but I got sidetracked and I haven't felt like I really must get back to it to read the, you know, to continue.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, you know, I will finish it at some point, but, you know, it's on my digital player. But at this point, I got involved in something else. And so I will get back to it at some point. But
anything else?
Let's see. What else have I been reading? Oh, yeah. I noticed on Bard that one of my favorite books from high school was just put up on there. And it was something that I read when I was like a junior or senior. And it's for young adults. I mean, it's fluff literature, essentially. But I thought it was a wonderful book when I read it. It's by Lois Duncan. And it's called Stranger with My Face.
Oh, interesting.
And it's about a girl who was adopted. And she's like half-blooded Native American or something. And she has a twin sister. And she and her twin sister, who she doesn't know about, at least until in the middle of the book, have the ability to astral project. So, you know, projecting their, I guess, souls, if you will, around to various places and locations. And the mischief that happens as a result of that.
Oh, fun.
And I found it a very fun read when I read it the first time. And when I read it the second time, it was equally fun. So,
oh, good. That sounds really interesting.
It was actually a very serious book. I mean, it's not like a humorous, funny book, but it was still a very interesting read. And also, I somehow got started reading Star Trek novels. So in the past month, I've read a few. And I haven't read that many of them in the past. But there was one author that I read one of her books a long time ago And it's in the Star Trek universe, and it's, you know, got some of the characters in it. And she wrote another book, and I had seen the title of it before, and I thought, you know, this is kind of a paradox, because the title is called The Vulcan Academy Murders.
Uh-huh.
And Vulcans are, at least a lot of them, in the Star Trek universe, are sort of pacifists. So I'm thinking, okay, why are all these Vulcans starting to kill people? You know, why would there be murder on Vulcan? So I read it, and it's by Jean Laura, and it was a fascinating read. And so then other Star Trek books started falling in my lap, and I think I may probably read at least three or four of them in the past month. Another one that I read that was very good, that did not really, the sort of like main characters of the, you know, Star Trek, you know, the crew of the Enterprise and all that, they weren't really main characters in this book. So it took, if you want that, it takes a little getting used to, because you don't see anyone from the Enterprise until more than halfway through the book. But it was called The Romulan Way, and it's by Diane Duane. And actually, I think Madeline Bazard was the narrator on Bard, and I really don't like her voice. I don't care for her. But I will say that there was a lot of Romulan in the book, and she did pretty well with it, at least in the beginning. So, you know, I commend her with that. It was basically about an undercover Federation agent who goes into the Romulan Empire to learn secrets. And she attaches herself to a household and basically is like an indentured servant. They think she's a Romulan, you know, she's been surgically altered and all this kind of thing. And mm-hmm. so, she goes in there, and then it's, you know, she's been there for years and years, and it's basically her decision whether to help her Federation counterparts, who get into some trouble when they're, you know, when they're on Romulus or whatever the homeworld's called, or to, or not, and what to do after she, or if she decides to help them. So, that was a very interesting sort of human interest type of story. And, for those of you like me who are interested in, the split between the Vulcans and the Romulans and how that may have happened in that particular universe, the book provides some information on that. So it was very, I thought it was a cool book.
And yes, really cool.
I'm a Star Trek person. I like Star Trek.
I like Star Trek too, but I'm not, I'm only a very, very casual fan.
Yeah,
so the process of like reading, finding good tie-in novels has always seemed a bit like
difficult. Because a lot of Star Trek literature is focused on characters that you already know, you know, like from the television shows or the movies or what have you. So if you don't know at least a little bit about, you know, who's who in Whoville, so to speak, it may give you, you know, it may be difficult to get into that. I will say that I wish Bard would put up a trilogy of books by Greg Cox, which are some Star Trek Next Generation books, all about this character Q, who's essentially a mischievous sort of demigod that appears in the shows from time to time. And there have been a lot of books written about him because people are fascinated by him and all the trouble he can get into. And this Q Continuum trilogy by Greg Cox would be so much fun if Bard put it up there. It's like he accidentally lets another very crazy demigod into our galaxy, and this crazy demigod wreaks havoc everywhere. And he and his cohorts, he also lets in a couple other semi-crazy demigods, and they wreak just, I mean, tremendous havoc. Yet I say again, havoc. And so the three books talk about the havoc that they create, sort of like in the past and in the present, because they start acting up again. And one thing that would be really interesting is one of these characters, one of the crazy demigods, has a name that is entirely punctuation marks. So
wow.
How is a narrator going to render that? It's like asterisk, exclamation mark, dash, asterisk, or something like that. And the reason I know this is because I got the books from the library and scanned them because I thought they were so good. You know, I just went, this was when I had a public library card. I no longer have one for the reason of hoarding books. but I went and got them, and I was like, scanning the page, I'm thinking, is this what the name is supposed to be? And it ended up, you know, that was what it was. But, you know, how is a narrator going to read asterisk dash exclamation point asterisk? And how is it even pronounced? So that would be funny if they got those up there. And then they got to the second book, which I think is when that character comes in and be like, oh, I'm going along pretty well here. And how do I read that? So anyway, so that's basically what I've been reading. Star Trek books and astral projection books. And that's pretty much it. I haven't been out of my comfort zone very much this month at all, which is kind of sad.
Oh, well, the comfort zone is overrated sometimes.
Sometimes it is. But I think I was sort of trying to keep in the science fiction spirit so that when I got to the Hunger Games, you know, I would still be sort of in that mode. But I don't need much help to decide that science fiction books are, you know, a good thing to read. So that's just an excuse to stay in my comfort zone. So shall we talk about the Hunger Games?
We should talk about the Hunger Games. I have to admit that I have been very busy, and so I had not had a chance to sit down and read the Hunger Games, but I did today.
Wow.
And I finished it. I started at 2 o'clock this afternoon my time, and we're recording it about 7 o'clock my time, and I got it done in 4.5 hours.
Good for you. You must have been on speed 6 with that digital reader there.
Yeah, she was reading very fast.
Was it, were you reading the Bard version?
I was reading the Bard version, and I really liked her. I like Erin Jones a lot.
I do, too. I think she's a wonderful narrator, and she has a very brisk style.
She does, but she's also very good at drawing out the emotions.
Absolutely.
This was a reread for me, and the first time I read it, I think I just used the Bookshare copy, mm-hmm. and I read it with the text-to-speech, and I remember thinking that, this was really good, but, you know, it's, a lot of it was because there's so much hype around those books,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't really want to be in love with it, but this time I really just couldn't have stopped if I'd wanted to. In fact, I remember thinking, when I had about an hour to go, I kept being relieved that it was... that I still had some time.
Right, because you don't want to stop that in the middle, you know.
Yeah.
So you finally finished it. And I actually read that too, used that version too. And I have heard clips from the Audible version. And I don't like that reader as well. And I think in some cases it's what you're used to. But
yeah.
I do agree that Erin Jones has a great flair for drawing out the emotion. And she has kind of a no-nonsense approach, but yet she can do the emotions, you know, that would come.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good thing. And I read it first last, I guess it was November or December, because we had a book club and we read it for the book club. And I said, okay, I'll read it. And then we liked it so much. The next month we read the second one. And then the next month we read the third one. And then the movie came out. So we all went to see the movie. Last Sunday on April 1st. Oh, it was April Fool's Day. Wah! And I had not reread the book since before I saw the movie, I was going to reread it, and I didn't. And I wish I had. But before I get to the movie, what did you think of the book?
I really liked it. Especially on a reread, I noticed a lot more, I really like Katniss as a character, and one of the things that's kept me from reading further in the series is that so many people were kind of on this whole Team PETA versus Team Gale thing.
Oh, it's so stupid.
Yeah, which is very stupid, especially if you actually read the books and realize how ambivalent she is to the whole idea of romance at all.
Exactly. And even in the first book, there's no real talk about whether she wants to be romantically involved with either one of them. I mean, there is the whole, the Hunger Games, you know, game makers are trying to make out like she and PETA are passionately in love with one another type of thing, when, you know, really they're not. In the beginning of the book, she does say she doesn't even know if she wants to bring kids and, you know, children into the world. So why would she even have any kind of romantic interest or let herself feel? I think she said something like, why would she let herself become involved with someone? Because bringing children into the world would just be so dangerous.
To do exact, to put their names in that, in the bowl.
For the reaping. Know,
for, yeah. And it's just, I thought that Katniss was very, very human. Like, I really, I rooted for her the entire time. And I liked that she was tough, but she wasn't bitchy. And honestly, like, on this reread, I kind of thought that PETA was a bit of a, like, he wasn't stupid, you know, he was basically a decent guy, but he kind of annoyed me. Like, I think it was just, like, because I was so, like, into Katniss's perspective, like, the whole, I mean, I felt like he really truly was in love with her, and there was, like, so it's like, well, there's no way that this is gonna end well for you, dude, you know?
Yeah.
And it didn't. Spoiler alert. I guess we should probably warn people that,
yeah, there are spoilers,
spoil the heck
in here
out of this book.
So if you haven't read it, you may want to read it before continuing listening, or just say forget it and try and get a skewed perception of what it's about by listening to us.
Yes.
So yeah, I know what you mean, and I think you know, I mean, I think that was probably what the author intended, because this is not like, you know, third person omniscient when you're talking about viewpoint. This was, you know, first person Katniss. So,
yeah,
you know, this is the way she's perceiving everyone. And so I can understand how, you know, he would get annoying. And I, you know, in the books that come after this one, Gale is the one who annoys me. So, you know, and Katniss ends up getting annoyed with him later on. And so I think that's, you know, the author does a good job of kind of like making you feel about the characters the way that Katniss feels about them.
Yeah. But I feel like, you know, if anybody really, really wants to read those books for, like, oh, who will Katniss end up marrying and having
babies
with?
That's not what they're,
like,
about. You don't. I mean,
I really also, I freaking loved Rue the second.
Oh,
I mean, I loved her the
wonderful
first time around, but I,
yeah,
really loved that character.
I agree. She was so brave in her own way, and you kind of wonder, you know, Katniss said she reminded her a lot of her sister. And of course, Katniss went into the arena anyway to save her sister from that. And I wonder if, you know, if her sister would have fared as well as Rue did in the arena.
Yeah.
Rue really did have a skill that she could use. You know, she could climb trees, and that's how she stayed alive for that long. So I thought she was great and loyal and definitely smart for bringing on those crackerjackers.
Yeah. I do have to say, though, that my major complaint with the books is I really hate, like, most of the names for things that Suzanne Collins chooses to use as, like, crackerjackers, like...
No, trackerjackers.
Or tracker... Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, you knew what I meant.
Yeah. I just, like, well, buy me some peanuts and, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And the Jabberjays, and, you know, even the Mockingjay, like, I feel about the Mockingjay about the way I feel about, you know, the Jayhawk, which is, you know, my university's symbol. Like, neither of them are real actual birds,
right,
but it's like, and then, like, you know, you have characters named Gale and PETA, and I kept thinking, PETA the baker's son, huh? Like, does he have a brother named Hummus?
Well, I think it's probably, the way I took it was that it, you know, this is a couple hundred years in the future, and the way languages evolve, a lot of times the ending consonants will fall off of words. So it may have been Peter at one point, and then the name changed.
Yeah.
To reflect that. And that's kind of the way I took it.
And I know I'm being nitpicky.
Yeah, I understand that. I get that.
Why
not just name him Peter?
So, I mean, just really, PETA, especially when I think about, like, the whole Baker son thing, I just, you know.
Yeah.
He is bread boy in my head.
And, you know, the tracker jackers and the mutations.
Yeah.
That was sort of irritating. But, yeah, I understand. I don't know. What did you think about the world itself? I mean, do you think this is, I guess this is sort of like dystopian. I don't know that we would call it post-apocalyptic literature.
No, because the apocalypse happened a long time ago. So I guess dystopian would be, I thought it was like, and there is an article that we're linking to that talks a little bit about this, the whole, it talks about, you know, is the violence in the movie, particularly of the Hunger Games. And it talks about how if you're reading this book, you're rooting basically for kids to kill each other.
Yeah.
And like that makes you sort of complicit in it is the argument that he makes. And I don't know that I actually felt that way reading the book. I didn't feel like, I felt like Katniss didn't really want to be killing anybody, and she doesn't really. I mean, I think she kills, like, maybe a couple of people, but she really, you know, it's not like she's going around being like, you know, hi-ya!
Yeah, exactly. I think the article, I mean, I think you summarized it pretty well, but I think the author overlooks something pretty significant. You know, Suzanne Collins takes a great deal of trouble to put us in that world. And I don't think the person who wrote the article has the particular mindset that you would have if you lived in those times under those circumstances. I mean, you know, he says something like, well, you know, this means that you're complicit in it. And actually what's going on is that these people are fighting for survival. And I've described this book as Survivor on steroids.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. Except, I mean, obviously there's more at stake than just $1 million. There's, you know, your families and your town's livelihoods. And so, you know, it when you have, you know, basically what it amounts to is the capital has bullied everyone into sort of levels of serfdom, depending on how far you are from the capital, I guess, is how she describes it. And that's the way that they, you know, treat people. They bully people all day long, every day. The peacekeepers are there to bully people. The capital keeps people on the edge of starvation. The only way you can get extra food and grain for your family is when you turn 12, put your name in the reaping bowl time and time and time again, so your tesserae gets bigger. That's, you know, that's the way you get your food, and your chances that maybe, you know, one day you'll be in the arena with the other people. But, you know, so in order to get more food, you're essentially putting your life on the line.
Yeah.
And I don't think the author kind of realized that this is really a survival game, and not even a game when it comes down to it. I mean, it's really, you know, they're trying to survive. And his claim is, well, they're just perpetuating the system, playing the game, and why don't the kids just decide not to play?
Because if you did that, like, then, it, you know, according to the rules of the story, like, they, I mean, the game makers are essentially omnipotent. You know, if the kids decided not to play, you know, they're not the ones with the power.
Exactly.
And you know, like, as you see at the end, when Katniss and PETA kind of do their suicide pact, knowing that it's not going to work, or knowing that the capital isn't going to let them do that, like, if that's the only thing they can do.
Exactly. And they talked about what would happen if they didn't play. And I think this person is not reading the book, you know, completely to realize. They talk about it. You know, that she talks about, well, if I don't, you know, if I didn't go to the arena, then, you know, basically, if you're in the arena and you don't, you know, move, you could be blown up by all those mines. Essentially, you're standing in a minefield when this starts. You know, before you even get to the cornucopia, if you don't move when the gong, when the cannon goes off, or however they started it, I can't remember. Essentially, you're blown to smithereens. Even before
You know, they can control the weather, for heaven's sake. So,
and I mean, even before that, they talk about, you know, if you weren't to play the game, then the game makers could come after you and come after your family. And not the game makers, the people in the Capitol could come after you and after your family and basically kill everybody. So there's really not much of a choice. You draw your name or you volunteer and you kind of have to play. And once you're in the arena, you're in the arena, and the game makers can do whatever they want. And, you know, basically it's a free-for-all for them, and you're trying to stay alive. I do find the concept of having to kill your fellow opponents troubling.
Oh, well, yeah. But I think you're supposed to.
Yeah, I think that's the deal. And I think that, you know, you're right in saying that, you know, when they do their little suicide, let's eat the berry pact at the end, that's the only thing that they can do to defy the Capitol and try and defy the system. So, you know,
ruin the story for the rest of, for you
those
know,
of you who have not read it yet.
Yeah. But I mean, like, I guess what I'm actually saying is, like, you know, that's the only way they could defy them is to ruin the story that the Capitol had perpetrated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't look very good if all of a sudden the lovers decide that, you know,
they're going to die.
Instead of killing each other, they're going to
die together.
Die together, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really understand what this person is saying, because obviously teenage bullying is not something you want. But
right.
I think in this worldview that we've got going on, the Capitol is a bunch of teenagers who are bullying everybody, and it's the only language that they understand. So that's the way you got to play.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you said, you know, we talk a little bit about one of the articles, and I guess I'm sort of going along with other things that we had kind of set to talk about. You know, as we've both kind of pointed out, the books have gone enormously popular. I think, when was the first one? 2006? Something like that.
2008 was what they said on the Bard thing. Was the copyright date, which seems very, like, was it that?
I thought it was 2006, but whatever it was, you know, they've been around, and, you know, the Hunger Games has an official website with all sorts of links to, you know, not only, of course, purchasing the books, but also to the author, you know, about the author and about the movie, which was filmed here in North Carolina, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll get to that in a minute, but also, Suzanne Collins has written an unofficial Hunger Games cookbook.
Yeah, I thought that was really, really kind of cool. And I remember thinking to myself, really, when I first, like, saw that link. And then I thought about how much food there actually was in the book, like descriptions of the foods that they ate in.
Yeah,
of the districts.
I know. And I didn't realize it. And when I went to see the movie the other night, a couple weeks ago, we had a potluck dinner, and the person who hosted it made things from the cookbook. And I didn't realize how much food there was until she started, like, handing out little mini cheese balls made from goat cheese and herbs. And I thought, well, yeah, I guess there was a goat, and they talked about making cheese and milk from the goat, and, you know, Katniss, her dad showing her the herbs and everything, so fresh herbs. And she made some other things from the cookbook. I don't remember what it was. Oh, and I do know one thing. It was not discussed in the books, of course, but in future books, Gale gives Katniss a kiss, and Katniss says that the kiss tastes like oranges. So there is Gale's kiss cake in the book, and it tastes like oranges. It has a very faint orange flavor. It's actually sensational. It's like a peanut brittle frosting, and then like a layer of something that feels like peanut brittle. It's not, but it's like really crunchy, and then a cake underlayer.
Oh, so like Keith bars or something?
Kind
like
of,
that?
Yes. Except it's homemade. It's not
right.
She told me how she made it. Now I don't remember, but It's really, really good and actually does taste like oranges.
Oh, that's cool.
And there were some other things that she made, but you know, our hostess actually said she bought the cookbook because she thought it was so interesting, you know, that it had a whole cookbook. And I haven't bought it and I don't have it, but that is, I think, sort of fun.
I know that I saw it in the iBook store.
Yeah.
I have not bought it either, but I saw it there.
And also, they have not only, of course, the website, but also a whole bunch of iPhone and Android apps for the Hunger Games. You've got a game, the Hunger Games Arena app, I think, and you've got some wallpapers and some other things that you can, you know, customize your phone with, all about the Hunger Games. And as far as accessibility with VoiceOver, I have no idea, but I thought it was kind of fun.
That is kind of fun, although it seems like that would be sort of missing the whole point of, like...
Yeah, I completely agree. I completely agree. So, you know, because I guess you're trying to go through the arena, and it's kind of like, well, but they already did that.
And they told about how traumatic that would actually be for you. And
right.
But now we're going to, like, do it on the iPhone.
Yeah, it's sort of irritating and silly, but... and of course, you know, although the books are really, you know, really good sellers, of course, you know, they weren't on the bestseller list forever, but when the movie came out, the book was, it went back into the top 10 for like at least a couple weeks. Actually it became number one on the Kindle bestseller list for a week.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
Should we move on to the movie?
Yeah, let's move on to the movie. I had the feeling that it was going to be very visual because The Hunger Games is like a reality TV, you know, event in the book. And so that's how they portray it in the movie. And a couple days before I went, I actually had a conversation with someone else who went, you know, not with me, of course, but, you know, with his girlfriend. And we talked about, you know, what it was like for him. And he said he hated it. And I said, why? And he said, well, the camera is very jittery, like if it was being filmed, you know, some of those, like, not handheld cameras, but like the ones they use on reality TV shows where they go around and, like, film the various contestants.
Yeah.
And that's what it was like. And he's a very motion sensitive person and he gets very easily motion sick. And so that made him very uncomfortable watching the camera, you know, jitter like that. And I thought, oh, well... If it's that way, then my guess is it would be filmed sort of like it was happening, you know, on television, sort of like as the audience would see it. And to some extent, I mean, you know, after the train ride and everything, it kind of is. There's not a whole lot of dialogue. There's some. And I think a lot of the casting was very well done. The person who plays Effie, the sort of District 12... What would you even call her? Cheerleader.
Right.
She was very good. She was good. Katniss was good. She was very, and there wasn't anyone save for Donald Sutherland, who was in the movie in a sort of minor role. I don't think there was really anyone well known. Anyway, so Katniss and, you know, was pretty well done. She was, had that same sort of sense of grit about her that she does in the book, but, you know, a very human person. And I thought that the master of ceremonies, what was his name in the book? Caesar,
some like very
Flickerman,
complicated. Yeah.
Flickerman. That's what it is. Caesar Flickerman. He was very, whoever played him was really good too. You know, was very good at, you know, making it sound like you were in the most wonderful place in the world watching the Hunger Games, you know. And really, once it's very hard to describe this because it did not feel like a streamlined experience. It was like scenes sort of spliced together, and the whole movie felt that way for me. It was like just things sort of thrown together, which I guess is how it would be if you were watching it, you know, on TV.
Right.
But even, you know, even the train ride, even before that was like that, it just all felt really, you know, thrown together. Once they got through the interviews and everything, there really was not any dialogue again until after the Tracker Jacker incident.
Well, I guess there really wasn't in the book either.
There wasn't in the book either, and so it doesn't surprise me. You know, like they went and they, you know, went through the tunnel and you could hear them entering, you know, and standing on the plates and, you know, the start, you know, when they're, you know, she ran away from the cornucopia and everything. But there really wasn't much dialogue again until, like I said, you know, they heard PETA and his group of folks that he allied himself with, you know, running around, and they set the Tracker Jackers on them. But really, throughout most of the movie, there's not a whole lot of dialogue. It's like Castaway.
I remember hearing you say that on the Tech Access Weekly.
Yeah, it is. Not quite as bad, but, you know,
and now I feel
stretches.
Like we should insert that clip of Tom Hanks going, "Wilson, I'm sorry."
Oh, God. I've never seen the movie.
Sorry.
I've never
seen it. I haven't either, really, but I do know that, like, that one bit of dialogue when he loses the volleyball. Sorry for spoiling it.
It's okay.
And he's like, "Wilson, come back!"
Yeah, because Wilson was the volleyball, right?
Right, right.
I hear a tagline for this podcast right now. Wilson, come back!
I know.
So, anyway, yeah, I mean, I, you know, as a blind person, I sort of knew what was going on because I had read the book. And apparently it was quite similar, except for there were some scenes in the end that were altered, and I'll get to them in a minute, to make it more PG-13 friendly. But, you know, I kind of knew that there were going to be Tracker Jackers. I want to call them Cracker Jackers. Gee, I wonder why.
Got you to do it, too.
Yeah, well, I started doing it in the first place. You know, and that she, you know, found PETA and he was wounded and, you know, got into the cave and went to get the medicine and all this kind of thing. And there was some dialogue to join this together. It wasn't like it was completely silent. But I, you know, so I kind of knew what was going to happen. If I had been a blind person by myself in a theater watching this movie, I would have been totally lost. I actually know of some sighted people who said that if they had not read the book first, they would have been lost.
That's what I heard, too. I heard that it was, that they tried to get too much of it in there, perhaps, and didn't quite succeed in telling.
I think they tried to make it too much like a reality TV show. And I think because they did that, it was like they spliced all these little things together, and it didn't really seem like a story got told, at least not to my satisfaction. Now, having said all that, there were other people who said they loved the movie, thought it was awesome, and don't even think they need to read the book. So, you know, opinions can vary.
Yeah.
The people I went with said that they liked the movie but really preferred the book. But, of course, we're all readers of, you know, this was all book club people.
Right.
So, of course, we're going to mostly prefer the books. Having said that, there were a couple of scenes that I asked after the movie. I'm not one of those people that likes to lean over and say, "What's happening now?" You know, it's just not me. So after the movie, I kind of had a discussion with one of the women that, you know, what were some of the things that were altered? And one of the most significant things is at the end, you know how they set the pack of mutations on them?
Uh-huh.
And each of the dog-like creatures in the book has the face of one of the tributes, and they have to kill them.
Yeah.
In the book, they're just dogs. But just, you know,
yeah.
Like,
that seems a little, like...
It was very disturbing.
I don't know how I, like... That seems... I mean, I guess I understand why they'd make that modification. I can't judge them for that. But, you know, like, I think that would be very hard to pull off, like, CGI-wise.
Yeah, and I think another... I believe that another modification they made was, you know, how Cato got into that cornucopia to hide from the mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that didn't happen. That was very, very disturbing in the book when he... you know, got in there and was, like, essentially begging for mercy, and they were, like, taking pieces out of him, essentially.
Yeah.
And that was not... I think the way it ended in the movie, it was very fast-paced going, but I think it ended up... He did get killed by them, but not in that really brutal, slow way that they described in the book. I think he just, you know, got attacked and torn up or something a little bit. But so I think those were two of the main things that were, you know, significantly that were used to kind of get the rating down a little bit. But I don't think, I mean, they really impacted the story and made it less less interesting.
Yeah, so, and, you know, those seem like sort of sensible modifications, so.
And there may have been others, but those are the ones that I you know, know about and noticed. I think those are the ones that are, you know, the most significant. But I thought it was awesome. One of the really cool things I liked about the movie was that it was not necessarily all from Katniss's viewpoint. You had other stuff going on in the background, you know, from when she was in the arena until the end. Basically, one of the things that was kind of interesting was President Snow would talk to one of the game makers, I think it was one of the game makers, and tell him what they needed to put in the game, you know, and why they were doing what they were doing. Essentially giving the motivations behind, you know, the Hunger Games and the Capitol and its regime, kind of as he was doing it.
Right, because if you're doing a reality montage type thing, I would think that would be really hard to show in a movie.
So he was basically saying, this is how we're going to... I mean, he wasn't trying to teach the game maker the Capitol's philosophy. He was like saying, this is how you should make them do this and this, and this is the reason why we want them to, you know, be like star-crossed lovers or like, you know, the lovers who... win the games, and this is why we don't want them to win, you know. And I think Haymitch was also there trying to convince, you know, the game makers and sponsors to act in certain ways, and that was interesting. And then the cool thing from my Trek techie perspective is that you actually see the game makers making the game. So in other words, when you know, not like, not often, just a few times, when they wanted to get Katniss and the other participants to go in towards the middle of the arena, you know how they had the fire?
Yeah.
The big ring of fire. Well, they said, oh, we want them more towards the center, so move the ring of fire 50 meters that way and 50 meters that way, you know, and they were just doing it on the computer, you know, you could see them. Moving it around and telling each other how to do it. And that was kind of cool.
Oh, that is really cool.
And they had a couple other sort of short 10-second segments of them doing that. So those things are really neat. And I think overall I did enjoy the movie. I was surprised that the soundtrack has done so well in sales. You know, it was number one on the Billboard charts for a while, and I think some of the songs are still up there. None of the songs were in the movie.
Oh, that's very strange. That's what I heard,
the
too.
The whole movie score was like this wonderful sort of symphonic orchestral thing. And there was, I mean, it was nice if you liked like classical-y type music in the movies and stuff. And it was good, but none of the songs were in there, except when the credits rolled at the end. The first song on the soundtrack kind of accompanied the credits. But otherwise, that was it.
That's really interesting to me. Like, I wonder why they chose to do that with the soundtrack, if there really wasn't much of a soundtrack to be.
There are a lot of songs on there. There's like 16 songs. I have a copy of the soundtrack, and it's pretty decent. But, you know, I don't know why they chose to do that. One question that someone asked was, she thought that, I think Amber Wallenstein was the one who asked this question. She was very moved by the fact that Katniss sang to Rue, you know, as she was dying. And she wondered if that happened in the movie, and I told her I'd answer on the podcast. No, maybe it was Diana. I can't remember who asked these questions. It was a Twitter question. And I think it was Diana who asked. And so, yes, Diana, for your information, Katniss does sing to Rue in the movie. And they have that little song in there. So it was really sweet. They did keep that portion in there, and I'm glad they did that.
Yeah, even though like all the hubbub about Rue being black just seems absolutely. Oh,
I didn't know that.
Apparently, I saw an article somewhere, and now clearly I should have like linked to it. I'll find it, but
okay.
There's apparently some controversy about the fact that they cast Rue as a black actress.
I didn't know she was. So there you go. Didn't make a difference to me. Just
oh, and it talks about her brown skin. So like, why wouldn't
yeah?
She
I mean,
be?
It, they don't mention it in the movie, but they mention it in the book. It's not something that comes up in the movie, but it makes sense that they would, because in the book they talk about, you know, they talk about the fact that she's got brown skin. So it would makes perfect sense.
So, you know, people.
I know. They'll make controversy out of anything.
Yeah.
So, well, no, go ahead.
I was just going to wind this down and say that I'm glad that you enjoyed the movie. I have not seen it, but I really would like to, especially since I just gobbled through the book, and now I really want to gobble through the next one.
I would recommend that you have someone with you to watch it with you.
Yeah, either that or I'll wait for the DVD, which might hopefully have a DVS track on it.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but I mean, I don't think I really missed much. I don't think I really missed much, but I would have been very lost if I hadn't read the book.
Yeah. And now I've read it twice, so.
There you go. I've read it twice, too. I came back from the movie and decided that before we did the podcast, I needed to read it again. Because I hadn't read it since November or October or whenever it was I read it last or first time. So all this being said, we should probably wind this down and start talking about our homework for next time.
Yes, our homework for next time. We were talking before we recorded. So in the pre-show, I think that's what I meant to say, that it would be sort of difficult to assign homework that, like, neither of us had read.
Exactly.
So, my thought had been that since we read The Hunger Games for this time, we should read something completely different. So I suggested that we read Sarah Addison Allen's book, The Sugar Queen, which is totally and completely different from The Hunger Games.
Since I haven't read it, what's it about? I mean, not like giving spoilers, but a type of genre.
It is a it's set in the South. I want to say it is one of the Carolinas, but now I can't remember which.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about this woman who lives with her mother, and she has basically kind of been domineered by her mother her entire life, and she escapes by having this like closet that she keeps stashed full of like junk food and romance novels and
wonderful.
And it's kind of her hiding place from the world. And then this ghost moves into that closet and tells her that she needs to go buy a sandwich from this other woman that lives in town. And it's kind of a, like there's, I guess you call it magic realism, because it's not quite fantasy in the sense that there are like there's magic and stuff going on, but it's like not very heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just quirky enough that like most magical realism type of things tend to annoy me because it feels like it's very affected. But I feel like Sarah Addison Allen's writing style is straightforward, and I mean, I'd be interested in your perspective on it, because like, I'm not from the South. I may be moving to the South,
right,
but I'm not from the South,
right,
but I feel like it has a very Southern it feels very authentically Southern to me.
Okay, well, what is magical realism?
It's like again, like there's stuff that happens, like, and one of the examples that I can think of is that the woman who becomes the friend of the girl with the romance novels in the closet, she gets followed around by books. Like, whatever situation she is in, like, a book will just sort of appear.
Okay.
And it becomes this sort of
running, I guess it's
gag.
Good if we're
the
book hoarders. This is a good
kind
book
of
to read.
There.
That's funny.
And it is funny, but it's really cool. I kind of want to be like, yeah, hello, random book. Where'd you come from? Now I have something to read.
Random books are good.
So it sounded, it seems to me like this one would totally be a book hoarder if she were not a fictional character.
That's excellent.
It's kind of like that. Like, you know, there's magic and stuff like that in the stories, but it's not like elves and dragons kind of thing. It's very subtle.
Oh, that's good. I'm looking forward to that. So that is our homework for next time, folks. Last time I chose the book. This time she chooses the book. And next time, we want you to choose the book.
Yes.
So closer into the next time we start recording, and, you know, about a week or so beforehand, we'll send out a tweet reminding you to send us your suggestions for the next homework assignment. And you can do that by sending... You can start suggesting now if you want to. You can send a tweet to Book Hoarders on Twitter, or you can email bhapodcast@gmail.com. I had to swallow there. Sorry about that. Throat's getting dry here. I've babbled on way too much. So that's the main contact information for us anyway. So any commentary of any kind, you can send those to particular places.
Yes. And, or you can follow us on Twitter. I am Bardsong, B-A-R-D-S-O-N-G.
And I'm just good old boring Aaron Edgar.
Aaron Edgar.
And if you want to check out my other podcast, it's Tech Access Weekly at techaccessweekly.com.
And we have a Goodreads page, too.
Yes, we do. And you can find us on Goodreads and Book Hoarders.
Yes.
And we also have personal Goodreads pages. Mine doesn't get updated nearly as much as it should.
I kind of tend to be a little obsessive about mine, so.
I should be better. I read about 4 books, and I still haven't put them up there. But I'm better than I was last year at doing it. Let's just put it that way. But so that will probably end the podcast.
Yes.
What do you
think?
So
see you next time.
See you next time. We'll be back.
Bye.
Bye. To contact the Book Hoarders, send email to bhapodcast@gmail.com. Follow Book Hoarders on Twitter. And visit the website at bhapodcast.com.